Good evening. The United States Senate opens the impeachment trial of the president.
The Senate will proceed to consideration of the articles of impeachment against Donald John Trump, President of the United States.
18 years since Guantanamo prison is opened. Who's there and why? And New York adoptees get the right to see their birth certificates. With these and other stories, I'm Paul DiRienzo with the news for Thursday, January 16th, 2020. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye, intoned the Senate sergeant-at-arms, calling the proceedings to order at noon as the Senate opened the impeachment trial of President Donald Trump with ceremony on Thursday. Senators standing at their desks to swear an oath of impartial justice as jurors, House prosecutors formally reciting the charges, and Chief Justice of the Supreme Court John Roberts being sworn in.
A quorum is present under the previous order. At the hour of 2 p.m., that time arriving, and a quorum have been established, the Senate will proceed to consideration of the articles of impeachment against Donald John Trump, President of the United States. Majority Leader.
Mr. President, at this time, pursuant to Rule 4 of the Senate Rules on Impeachment and the United States Constitution, the presiding officer will now administer the oath to John G. Roberts, Chief Justice of the United States.
The escort committee will now conduct the Chief Justice of the United States to the dais to be administered the oath.
Senators, I attend the Senate in conformity with your notice for the purpose of joining with you for the trial of the President of the United States. I am now prepared to take the oath.
Will you place your left hand on the Bible and raise your right hand? Do you solemnly swear that in all things appertaining to the trial of the impeachment of Donald John Trump, President of the United States, now pending, you will do impartial justice according to the Constitution and the laws, so help you God.
I do. At this time, I will administer the oath to all senators in the chamber in conformance with Article 1, Section 3, Clause 6 of the Constitution and the Senate's impeachment rules. Will all senators now stand or remain standing? And raise their right hand. Do you solemnly swear that in all things appertaining to the trial of the impeachment of Donald John Trump, President of the United States, now pending, you will do impartial justice according to the Constitution and laws, so help you God.
Only the third impeachment trial in American history is unfolding in an election year at a time of deep division in the nation. Four of the senators sitting in judgment on Trump are running for the Democratic Party's nomination to challenge him in the fall. The Constitution mandates the Chief Justice serve as the presiding officer, and Roberts made the short trip across the street from the Supreme Court to the Capitol. Senators rose quickly when he appeared in his plain black robe. Trump faces two charges after the House voted to impeach him last month, one that he abused the presidential power by pressuring Ukraine to investigate Democratic rival Joe Biden, using military aid to the country as leverage. Trump is also charged with obstructing Congress's ensuing probe. At a news conference with a conservative religious freedom organization, today Trump again claimed he did nothing wrong.
It's a hoax. Everybody knows that. It's a complete hoax. The whole thing with Ukraine. So you have a perfect phone call. This is a call, fortunately, it was actually two phone calls. You people don't report that. There were two calls. They were both perfect calls. In fact, probably among the nicest calls I've ever made to foreign leaders. Now, so you have these perfect calls, and everybody says it now. Before they knew they were so good, because fortunately they were transcribed, you had other people saying terrible things about the calls. You had a fake whistleblower that wrote a report that bore no relationship to what was said. Everything was false. You have now the Ukrainian president and the foreign minister of Ukraine saying there was nothing done wrong. In fact, they said there was absolutely no pressure whatsoever. Everything was perfect, and they impeach. It's totally partisan. We had 195 to nothing Republican votes. I guess we got a Democrat actually came over to the Republican side. We had 195 to nothing. This is a hoax. It's a shame. I did the biggest deal ever done in the history of our country yesterday in terms of trade and probably other things, too, if you think about it, the deal with China. And that was the second story to a total hoax.
Trump is expecting acquittal in the Republican-controlled Senate, but new revelations are mounting about Trump's actions towards Ukraine. The Government Accountability Office, or GAO, said Thursday that the White House violated federal law in withholding the security assistance to Ukraine, which shares a border with Russia. Withholding the funds at the heart of Democrats' claim that Trump made a this-for-that deal with Ukraine to get dirt on his rival, former Vice President Joe Biden. At the same time, an indicted associate of Trump's personal lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, named Lev Parnas, has turned over to prosecutors new documents linking the president to the shadow foreign policy being run by Giuliani. Trump denied Thursday that he even knew Parnas.
I don't know Parnas, other than I guess I had pictures taken, which I do with thousands of people, including people today that I didn't meet, but just met him. I don't know him at all, don't know what he's about, don't know where he comes from, know nothing about him. I can only tell you this thing is a big hoax. It's a big hoax. We call it, this is the current hoax. We've gone through the Russian witch hunt. We've gone through a lot of them from probably before I came down the escalator, but certainly since I came down the escalator, you take a look at what's happened. And in the meantime, our country, it doesn't matter what he says. He's trying to probably make a deal for himself. I don't even know who this man is, other than I guess he attended fundraisers, so I take a picture with him. I'm in a room. I take pictures with people. I take thousands and thousands of pictures with people all the time, thousands during the course of a year. And oftentimes I'll be taking a picture with somebody. I'll say, I wonder what newspaper that one's going to appear in. No, I don't know him. Perhaps he's a fine man. Perhaps he's not. I know nothing about him. But I can tell you this.
More than just taking pictures of the president. He says
I don't know him. I don't believe I've ever spoken to him.
On the phone with Giuliani, and he said
I don't believe I've ever spoken to him. I meet thousands of people. I meet thousands and thousands of people as president. I take thousands of pictures. And I do it openly, and I do it gladly. And then if I have a picture where I'm standing with somebody at a fundraiser, like I believe I saw a picture with this man, but I don't know him. I had never had a conversation that I remember with him.
Certainly,
let me just tell you, you just have to take a look at the polls. Quiet.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said the new information from Parnas demands an investigation, which she doesn't expect from Trump's attorney general. Trump was also asked about a letter from Rudy Giuliani, Trump's personal lawyer, that he was working in Ukraine with full support and knowledge of the president.
Rudy Giuliani wrote a letter to Zelensky requesting a private meeting, and he said it was in his capacity as private counsel to President Donald J. Trump. This was before the inauguration. Did you authorize him to write that letter? And what was your understanding of what the meeting was supposed to be about?
Well, I don't know anything about the letter, but certainly Rudy is one of the great crime fighters in the history of our country. He's certainly probably the best over the last 50 years. He was also the greatest mayor in the history of the city of New York. I think Rudy was truly an outstanding mayor. It's an example. His endorsement of Bloomberg got Bloomberg elected. He wouldn't have even been mayor. But Rudy was the greatest crime fighter, and Rudy is somebody that, frankly, having him on my side was a great honor for me, and it has been a great honor for me. Rudy Giuliani did a phenomenal job over a long period of time in fighting crime. And, frankly, he's a very legitimate guy, a very straight shooter. I didn't know about a specific letter, but if he wrote a letter, it wouldn't have been a big deal. Rudy was always in. It was very important to Rudy that I be a great president, and that's okay with me. It was very important to a lot of people because our country was going to hell, and now our country's on a path that we haven't seen in decades and decades. We've never done better. Go ahead. No, not you. Go ahead.
The letters provided by Parnas, who's being prosecuted for election fraud, seem to imply that then U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine, Marie Yovanovitch, was being followed by men associated by Giuliani. Yovanovitch was forced to resign after a smear campaign was launched against her, apparently with White House backing. She was threatened at several junctures. In another blow to Trump's case, the GAO issued a legal opinion on Thursday saying that President Trump's administration broke the law by withholding the defense defense aid to Ukraine, the issue at the heart of the impeachment trial. That money, $214 million, which had been allocated to the Department of Defense for security assistance, was appropriated by Congress, and therefore the administration did not have the right to hold it back just because it disagreed with its allocation. That's the opinion from the nonpartisan government watchdog. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi had this to say on Thursday.
Today, and this is at the day that Government Accounting Office confirmed that the president's actions at the center of our impeachment articles, withholding congressionally approved military aid from Ukraine, was illegal. And these are their words. These are the words of the GAO. Faithful execution of the law does not permit the president to substitute his own policy priorities for those that Congress has enacted into law. The Office of Management and Budget withheld funds for a policy reason which is not permitted under the Empowerment Control Act. The withholding was not a programmatic delay. Therefore, we conclude that OMB violated the Empowerment Act. The OMB, the White House, the administration broke, I'm saying this, broke the law. They say, we conclude that they violated the Empowerment Control Act. This reinforces, again, the need for documents and eyewitnesses.
Meanwhile, the Senate will issue a formal summons to the White House to appear at the impeachment trial. The president's legal team expected to respond by Saturday. Opening arguments will begin on Tuesday. It would take a supermajority of senators, 67 of the 100, to convict the president. Republicans control the chamber 53-47, but it takes just 51 votes during the trial to approve rules, call witnesses, or dismiss the charges. Senators Susan Collins of Maine, Mitt Romney of Utah, Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, and Lamar Alexander of Tennessee want to call witnesses. Trump and Majority Leader Mitch McConnell want a short trial. Romney said he wants to hear from John Bolton, the former National Security Advisor at the White House, who others have said raised alarms about the alternative foreign policy toward Ukraine being run by Giuliani. And you're listening to the news on WBAI New York. I'm Paul DiRienzo. This weekend is the 18th anniversary of the opening of the Guantanamo Bay prison for suspected members of Al-Qaeda. Although the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq have been winding down, dozens of mostly uncharged prisoners are awaiting an uncertain fate, with a president who has stated he will never release any of them. Andy Worthington is co-director of a documentary about the Guantanamo detainees. He had this to say.
Hey, January the 11th was unfortunately the 18th anniversary of the opening of the prison at Guantanamo Bay. That, of course, is a prison that was opened by the Bush administration and was intended to hold people they'd seized in the war on terror that they declared after the 9/11 attacks and was intended to be beyond the reach of the U.S. courts. Why would you set up a prison outside the reach of the law? Well, obviously because you intended to do things that were illegal. I'm sure anyone who's been paying attention for the last 18 years will know that meant that what happened at Guantanamo was all kinds of torture and abuse. The really sad thing, Paul, 18 years on, to be having to still be campaigning for the closure of this wretched place is that it's been in the control now of Donald Trump for 3 years. In some ways, this is the darkest period of all, because Trump shut the door on the prison when he took office 3 years ago. He tweeted notoriously a couple of weeks before he was inaugurated, there must be no more releases from Gitmo. And he's been almost entirely true to his word. So he released one man who had entered into a plea deal in a military commission trial proceeding under President Obama, which he had to honor. He was sent back to Saudi Arabia to continue serving a prison sentence. But of his own free will, he's released nobody. He has no intention of ever releasing anybody while he is in control of that facility. And that, I think, fundamentally and sadly takes us back to the earliest days of Guantanamo, when the truth was more obvious, that this was a prison outside the law where fundamentally prisoners were so stripped of their rights that their fates were in the hands of the President of the United States and to some extent of the U.S. Congress. And if they didn't want to do anything about bringing them anything resembling justice. They didn't have to. And that's the situation that we have for the men who are still held today. They are really, in some fundamental way, worthy of being regarded as the personal prisoners of Donald Trump and of the U.S. Congress.
Who are the people who are in Guantanamo now? How many and who are they?
There are 40 men still held at Guantanamo. So, you know, we're down to 5% of the nearly 800 that were held throughout the prison's history. Over 500 released under Bush, 200 under Obama. So just 40 men. And, you know, perhaps people might get the feeling that if we're down to 40, these really must all be the worst of the worst bad guys. You know, the worst of the worst that we were told from the beginning were there. And yet it's still not true. Now, undoubtedly, there are some men held at Guantanamo who are accused of serious crimes. The whole thing was supposed to hinge on 9/11 and Al-Qaeda, and in fact, the men accused of that are held at Guantanamo. And they and a few others are stuck in a kind of broken Groundhog Day legal system, the military commissions, which were kind of dragged out of the history books after 9/11. The intention under Dick Cheney, who set them up, was that they would lead swiftly to the execution of prisoners who had been subjected to torture, but who had come up with confessions that they were involved in 9/11. And over the years, they were chipped away at, overturned by the Supreme Court, reinstated, suspended by Obama, reinstated by Obama. I mean, the system, unfortunately, is like a Swiss cheese. It has far more holes than substance in it, and it's a broken thing that keeps limping on. So that's nine of the men who are held. The other men, five of them were unanimously approved for release by high-level government review processes under President Obama, but nothing can compel Donald Trump to release them if he doesn't want to do, which he doesn't. So they very much are his personal prisoners, these five guys. And then 26 others, during the reviews that Obama did in his 8 years, it was decided that these guys were too dangerous to release, but insufficient evidence existed to put them on trial, which rather makes you wonder about the quality of the so-called evidence. Obama set up a parole-type process for these men, largely to overcome some terrible and unprincipled restrictions on the release of prisoners that had been put in place by Republicans in Congress. So the parole process kind of sidestepped issues of whether they were guilty of anything, whether they had in fact done anything wrong, or whether they were mistakenly held at Guantanamo, and required them to say that they had done something wrong, that they apologized for it, and that they had plans for a peaceful life if they were released from Guantanamo. But the guys still held are the ones who failed that hurdle. So they didn't convince a panel of military and intelligence officials that they didn't pose a threat.
This is political. This group of men in Guantanamo are part of an American domestic political thing.
Exactly, yes.
It has nothing to do with military or punishing terrorists. This is about Republican versus Democrat, conservative versus liberal. In the words of Donald Trump, those Americans who support terrorism and are traitors towards those who are loyal.
And in some ways, it's the United States against the law, demonstrating that the law is no obstacle to the United States government wanting to make a point about how tough it is.
Anything you would like to add?
I hope that people in the United States who care about justice will continue to reflect on the prison at Guantanamo Bay, because it isn't just on its own terms, and it should be obvious to anybody who isn't illiberal that having somewhere where the United States government can hold people forever without charge or trial, it's just fundamentally wrong. There is nothing in theory to stop the Guantanamo principle in the future being expanded to include somebody other than foreign Muslims. Why could it not become some domestic problem that some government, whether it's this one or a future government, perceives?
Andy Worthington is the co-director of a documentary about the Guantanamo detainees. And closer to home in New York State news, Assemblyman David I. Weprin, Senator Villa Minette Montgomery, Assemblywoman Pamela Hunter, Assemblyman Robert Carroll, and other elected officials joined several adult adopted individuals, birth parents, and adoptee rights advocates to announce the first day of access for adult adoptees seeking a copy of their original birth certificate. The Clean Bill of Adoptees' Rights was signed by Governor Andrew Cuomo in November. The legislation, which passed both houses of the legislature in 2019 after decades-long push by advocates and lawmakers, establishes the right of adoptees to receive a certified copy of their birth certificate upon reaching the age of 18. Assemblyman David Weprin of Queens.
In New York State, adoption birth certificates have been sealed at adoption since 1938. For the first time since 1938, as of yesterday, adoptees who are 18 years of age or older can apply either online or in person or by mail to get their original birth certificate, which should have the names of their biological parents, as well as certain other information like where they lived and other things on the actual birth certificate. This is something that adoptees have been across the country, but particularly in New York, have been advocating for in the legislature for probably over 50 years. I've been carrying the bill myself for about 9 years. There have been many other sponsors before me, but this is a very exciting event, and it's really a historic event in New York State. I predict it'll result in saving lives because people will not only find out their family history, they'll find out their medical history, because the first thing that happens if you have a medical emergency and you go to an emergency room or you go to a doctor, the first question they always ask is, is there a history of cancer in your family? Is there a history of diabetes, of high blood pressure, et cetera? And if you're an adopted person, you don't have the answers to that. So I predict that this will lead to people finding out medical history. It'll also lead for people to find siblings that they didn't know exist, biological brothers and sisters, and it may end up reuniting families.
Why did this take 50 years?
It shouldn't have. In a sense, it's an outdated law to seal the record. The opposition came mostly from people that were trying to protect birth mothers' anonymity, which we hadn't heard from. You know, we hadn't heard from birth mothers wanting to be anonymous. You know, there was supposedly alleged certain lawyers made representations to their clients who were arranging an adoption years ago that they would remain anonymous, but we've never ever seen anything in writing to that effect. And in fact, you know, we had a hearing, a full day hearing at 250 Broadway a couple of years ago, and no one came forward to testify that they ever had a document that promised anonymity upon adoption. It was used to advocate against the bill, but it really wasn't the case. I think a number of judges were opposed to it because it took the whole area out of the court system. It really shouldn't have been in the court system in the first place, because the average citizen should be able to get their birth certificate without any kind of legal proceeding or without hiring a lawyer. You know, years ago, there was a certain stigma to giving up a child for adoption, particularly for unwed mothers. A number of years ago, I know the Catholic Church at one point in certain states, and probably in New York at one point, opposed allowing unrestricted access to birth certificates because they were afraid birth mothers might be hesitant to give up children for adoption, and it might lead to abortions. But that never really materialized. That never really became a factual thing, and the Catholic Church withdrew any opposition years ago, because we had information that they were opposed to it quite a number of years ago, but in recent years we've never had any opposition from the Catholic Church or any other organized religion.
Did the change in the Senate, that now it's all Democrat and the Democrats control both houses of the legislature in Albany, have anything to do with it?
Yes and no. There were a lot of things happening change-wise, but I don't think it was a partisan issue. If you look at the vote in our House and if you look at the vote in the Senate, it was not under any partisan lines. We had opponents on the Democratic side and we had opponents on the Republican side. We ended up having overwhelming support, but those that did speak against the bill were mixed between Democrats and Republicans. So this was actually one of the few legislative issues since I'm in the legislature, and I'm here 10 years, and I've carried this bill for almost all of those 10 years. This is one of the few issues that did not break down on the partisan lines at all. We had Democrat, very large amount of Democrat and Republican sponsors. This actually was one of the issues that really brought the parties together and did not break down on any partisan lines at all.
Great. Anything you'd like to add?
this is a wonderful thing to reunite families. And I always looked at this as a human rights issue. Why should someone, through no fault of their own, who happens to be adopted in New York State when they're an adult, have any less rights in getting access to their birth certificate than someone that's a citizen of New York that was not adopted? And there's so many things we use birth certificates for. This is obviously something that's going to help a lot of people, but hopefully also reunite families that didn't necessarily know they existed.
And that's Assemblymember David Weprin of Queens. And Mayor Bill de Blasio released his preliminary city budget today. But a top climate policy leader says the mayor must prioritize renewable energy and energy efficiency. He has not done that in the budget, she says. That's the key point Maritza Silva-Farrell, a top climate policy leader and executive director of Align, made in reaction to the preliminary budget.
In order for this to be successful, we have to see money in the budget. And the mayor did not include any funds for renewable energy, specifically for this mandate, for the retrofits. And we believe that given that climate change is the biggest challenge we have, we see that the mayor didn't really put his money where his mouth is in his statement today.
Isn't the work that they're doing, the work to rehabilitate East River Park in order to raise it for flood protection, and the flood protection work they've been doing on the east side and two bridges in these areas and in Brooklyn, doesn't that count as expenses in that way?
We actually need to tackle this issue in all forms, from adaptation to mitigation, and also ensuring that we reduce our emissions in our city. That is just very little to do in if you compare to the amount of a threat that climate change is at this particular moment. So for us, what we are saying and what we believe is important for the mayor to actually take into his statement is just to invest in reducing emissions from a large building. I mean, if you think about it, 70% of emissions comes from buildings. We pass basically a legislation that is the only one in the country that can get us to meet our goals of 80 by 50, and not investing one penny on this will be a failure for us.
What is that goal, 80 by 50? What does that mean, 80 by 50 goal?
That was a goal that the mayor put forward, 80% of emissions reduction by 2050.
So you don't think that he'll be able to meet that goal?
No, if you don't put money into the investment of how do we ensure that all of these rent-regulated housing and public housing and public buildings are going to be upgraded and retrofit so that the emission reduction will take place and ensure as well that workers will be able to access to those jobs. And the city has a commitment to do so. The mayor actually said it in his statement when the legislation was passed, that this is something that we cannot ignore. And now seeing that there is no money in the budget to address this issue is problematic for us.
What do you think he should do, and what are you going to do, your group?
We believe that the mayor needs to be investing $1 billion annually to fund energy efficiency retrofits in affordable and public housing units, and $3 billion for a green bonds program to fund renewable energy projects. We know that these investments will help our city achieve the goals that I just mentioned, the 80 by 50 goals, and especially in those large buildings who are the source of emissions and pollution in our neighborhoods. So the mayor today didn't actually do that, and we're going to continue advocating, because in order for us to address climate change, we ought to actually put our money where our mouth is.
And Maritza Silva-Farrell is a top climate policy leader and executive director of Align. And that's some of the news for Thursday, January 16th, 2020. The news was engineered by Catherine Davis. For the WBAI News, I'm Paul DiRienzo.